From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan. Terry Gross is on vacation. On today's Fresh Air, from dust to dust, we consider everything from cosmic clouds to the microscopic particles in your juice glass with Hannah Holmes. Her new book is The Secret Life of Dust. Also, the story behind the discovery of surgery's Holy Grail. It took an unconscious collaboration of a con man, a dentist, and a scientist to introduce effective anesthetics into the operating theater. A talk with Julie Fenster, the author of Ether Day. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has some thoughts after viewing an exhibit of paintings by the Dutch abstract painter Piet Mondrian. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Mac Lee. The Justice Department today released a report highly critical of the government's investigation into the Wen Ho Lee case, but it says there's no evidence the Taiwanese-born scientist was targeted because of his ethnicity. NPR's Pam Fessler has this report.
The report says Wen Ho Lee should have been a suspect in the government's investigation into possible espionage involving the transfer of nuclear secrets to the Chinese. But it says the Los Alamos scientist should not have been the only suspect. The review by federal prosecutor Randy Bellows says the entire investigation got off to a bad start when the FBI accepted with little question a Department of Energy analysis that narrowed the focus almost exclusively on Lee and his wife. It says the initial investigation should have been, quote, a sieve resulting in the identification of a number of suspects. Instead, it ended up as a funnel from which only Wen Ho and Sylvia Lee emerged. It says this happened, though, not because of Lee's Chinese heritage, but because other suspects of different nationalities were improperly rejected as suspects. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Firefighters are considering calling in the military to help battle those out-of-control wildfires in Northern California, Nevada, Washington, and Oregon. The wildfires are being fueled by dry weather, gusty winds, and lightning. The largest blaze in Nevada has burned 82,000 acres and nearly doubled in size yesterday after the wind shifted. The biggest danger to structures is along the border with California, where air tankers and bulldozers are being used to protect 24 homes. Elsewhere, lightning has started at least 40 fires in Oregon. The first lawsuit against Bridgestone Firestone involving defective tires has gone to trial in the border town of McAllen, Texas. Janet Heimlich has more.
Bridgestone Firestone attorney Knox Nunnally told a jury he will show that tire tread separation did not cause the type of accident suffered by the plaintiffs. In March of last year, Joel Rodriguez, his wife Marissa, and two other family members were injured after a tire on their 1998 Ford Explorer blew out, causing the vehicle to roll over. Marissa Rodriguez will need a wheelchair for the rest of her life. Nunnally blamed the accident on Ford Motor Company. Tires manufactured by Bridgestone Firestone have been linked to more than 200 traffic deaths and 700 injuries in the U.S. Firestone has settled more than 150 cases for undisclosed sums. The Rodriguez family says they are going to trial to force Bridgestone Firestone to accept more responsibility. For NPR News, I'm Janet Heimlich in Austin.
A peace deal to end 6 months of fighting in Macedonia has been signed. NATO will be called upon to disarm ethnic Albanian rebels who have battled government forces. The British-led mission would last a month and include American troops. The Dow ended the day down a fraction to 10,415. The Nasdaq gained 25 points, and the S&P 500 rose a point to 1,191. This is NPR News in Washington. Members of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America voted today to study whether to support homosexual relationships and whether to allow clergy in committed gay and lesbian relationships to serve. Will Murphy of member station WFIU has the story.
In the past, the church has operated a don't ask, don't tell policy, allowing homosexuals to serve in the clergy as long as they remain celibate. Meeting in Indianapolis today, the 1,100 delegates voted to conduct a church-wide review of that policy and to issue a report on the matter in 2005. A separate proposal has been submitted for consideration that would officially end the church's ban on non-celibate gay and lesbian clergy. That motion was offered by a lesbian minister who was ordained by church bishops in spite of the church's prohibition. Her ordination resulted in censure from Bishop Mark Hansen, who was selected over the weekend to serve as the church's presiding bishop for the next 6 years. For NPR News, I'm Will Murphy in Indianapolis.
Texas jurors heard opening statements today in the trial of the first of six inmates accused in the murder of a police officer. The officer was gunned down Christmas Eve outside a sporting goods store. George Rivas is the accused trigger man and the leader of a group of inmates who escaped from a Texas prison last December. Prosecutors say the officer, who was shot 11 times, never had a chance. A bill to help improve the lives of farmers and ranchers has been signed into law by President Bush. More than $5 billion will go to farmers suffering from drought and low prices for grain. Mr. Bush calls the rescue package meaningful legislation, adding that a vibrant farming industry is essential to national security. The measure he signed is smaller than a Senate bill that would have provided $2 billion more in aid. I'm Mac Lee, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for people and institutions worldwide, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Neil Conan. Dust is the inconsequential substance you shake off your heels on the way out of town. It's the stuff of the elusive bunnies beneath our couches and the accusatory material that gathers atop the stationary bikes we bought with the best of intentions. Let's be honest, most of us don't think about dust a lot. Now, a new book argues that dust is the alpha and the omega, the origin of life and our inevitable fate. The book is called The Secret Life of Dust, From the Cosmos to the Kitchen Counter, The Big Consequences of Little Things. Author Hannah Holmes joins us from Portland, Maine. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Well, everything in your book comes back to dust, including the origins of our planet.
It's pretty wonderful, isn't it? I had no idea when I started that, well, it all did begin with dust. And billions of years ago, really the first dust coalesced to form our solar system. Without dust forming clumps in space, there would be no circumstance under which a solar system could form. Space is just too violent. But dust acts as a little womb, and it protects the things in its innards from the violent radiation in space and allows dust and gas to slow down and cool down and compress itself into things like stars and planets. And that's where we came from.
Is that stardust the same as the dust that's hiding beneath my bed right now?
There is some of that stardust beneath your bed right now, which is one of the things I find most endearing about house dust, is there's all kinds of really cool stuff in it, including dinosaur bones and bits of dead people from thousands of years ago, and yes, space dust. Space dust is still floating around in our solar system and throughout the cosmos. It comes to Earth in huge quantities. Every day there is space dust fluttering down onto the Earth, and it certainly does get into your house. One astronomy professor told me, we eat it.
And I have to say, I was astounded by the volume of dust that your scientists that you talked to found floating in the air, indeed rivers of dust that circle the planet.
That is a rather recent revelation, in part brought to us by NASA satellites, which have allowed scientists to really see from space the huge scale of these dust storms that come out of the world's big deserts. When an enormous dust storm comes out of the Sahara or the Gobi Desert, it blows a river of dust that is pale gold, and it swirls across the ocean. It looks like a yellow river flowing over a blue background. It's astonishing how thick it is and how long these rivers can go. They can flow for thousands of miles across the ocean.
Tell us the story of how bauxite, the stuff from which we get aluminum, how bauxite got to Jamaica.
There were some scientists who noticed a little mismatch in the soils of some Caribbean islands a few years ago. The actual rocks there tend to be gray coral stone, the skeletons of old coral.
That's how the island's built up.
Right. But on top of that sort of dead gray stone, there are beautiful red soils. And people began to wonder, how do you get a red soil from a gray rock? When they looked more closely, they found the geochemical signature of Saharan dust in this red soil, and were forced to conclude that the soil blew across the Atlantic Ocean and fell on these islands. Not in one big flight, mind you, but over millions of years. And when they got thinking about it, they found that the bauxite mines on Jamaica bear a bit of a resemblance to that same dust. They haven't done the same conclusive testing that they've done in Barbados, but it stands to reason. You have enormous concentrations of aluminum in the bauxite mines, and the Saharan dust is enriched in aluminum, and there's no real good source of aluminum on Jamaica itself. So that aluminum did come from somewhere else, and the only logical explanation is it came from the Sahara.
And that is an awful lot of aluminum dust that's blowing over there.
You have to really stop and think about how many tons of dust we're talking about. One estimate is that the Sahara throws up 1 billion tons of dust a year. A billion tons. That would actually fill boxcars that would wrap around the equator something like 8 times. It's a huge amount of dust, and that's 1 year. You can multiply that by millions of years, and yeah, you can start to get some aluminum cans building up there.
With all that dust in the atmosphere, is there any such thing as fresh air?
There is absolutely not. The cleanest air on the planet, as the book mentions, might put about 25,000 pieces of dust inside a juice glass sitting on the railing of a porch. There is no clean air. Fortunately, some of those clean places have more or less clean dust, meaning it's more natural than industrial.
Now, you live in Portland, Maine. Describe for us the kind of dust that you would typically experience if you went down to the beach there in Portland.
There's an enormous amount of salt dust that comes off the oceans. It blows up when white caps break. So there would be a lot of dust, salt dust hanging in the air and blowing around. It gives that wonderful smell.
Mm-hmm.
There might be some little blobs of pinene. That's a chemical shed by pine trees that tends to form little balls that float around in the air. You might also encounter some bits of dried up otter dung, perhaps. It's a sad fact that every single thing on Earth is falling apart, and you are breathing it.
And these engines, these rivers of dust that you talked about before, they're manipulated by weather systems and other things, but a dust storm out of the Gobi Desert you describe reaching the west coast of the United States, what, 4 days later?
Yeah, when dust gets up high in the atmosphere, there are very strong winds up there, and they can transport the dust very fast. And, Trans-Pacific crossing in 4 days, pretty impressive. And it means that you get a very high concentration of dust arriving in Seattle. Quite a surprise to scientists there to find thick Gobi Desert dust hanging around the neighborhood.
Have scientists yet figured out, with all of this dust in the atmosphere that they hadn't really thought about before, have they figured out what it's contributing to the arguments over global warming, for example?
One thing that they're perhaps starting to understand is that they way underestimated this little character. And in truth, there are a variety of characters because dust is a bit of everything. So desert dust, they're starting to draw some conclusions because it's pale-colored. It can reflect some sunlight, which should give you a cooling effect.
Mm-hmm.
But because it is a little rock, it absorbs some heat from the sun and actually heats up the atmosphere. Now, the net effect of those things, who knows at this point? Another kind of dust that's getting an awful lot of study right now is soot because, again, scientists, A, didn't know how much is up there, still working on that as well, and B, don't know what it does up there. Increasingly, they're realizing it's a terrific absorber of heat, just as black tarmac is down on the surface of the Earth. You have hundreds of thousands of little black rocks up there in the sky, and they also absorb an enormous amount of heat. What happens as a result of that? One effect is that it can foil the formation of clouds. Because it changes the temperature in the atmosphere, it can halt the circulation of moisture from the surface of the Earth up into the atmosphere. If you don't have moisture in the atmosphere, you don't have clouds. And clouds are a very powerful cooling force in our planetary system.
Because they block the sunlight.
Right, they reflect a huge amount of sunlight. So kill off the clouds and you end up with a warmer planet.
I was fascinated by the idea that each dust, each desert, for example, has its own unique signature.
Yes, and when scientists find dust in some strange place, like trapped in a Greenland glacier, they can isolate that dust that has fallen over thousands of years. They can take its chemical fingerprint, so to speak, and then they can go looking around the world to see where it came from. They can compare it to dusts from the Sahara, from the Taklamakan Desert, from the Kizilkum Desert, from the Gobi, and they can find another fingerprint that matches and conclude that the wind goes from point A to point B and drops that dust.
So it tells you a lot about the wind patterns that were evident whenever that dust fell, and there are other ways to measure that.
Yes, they can also get information about ancient winds from the size of the dust, because if the wind is stronger, it's going to pick up bigger dust, and the dust you see in a glacier will vary in size with time. And the reason scientists care about this is that it helps them to reconstruct the climate during the last ice age, which was a rather dusty period. So they can use dust trapped in glaciers to paint a picture of how strong the winds were, where they blew from, long, long ago.
Several times, in several different places in your book, on issues ranging from the climate to medicine, you write that, you know, scientists didn't take dust seriously until very recently, and because, and the reasons vary. Why do you think it was that science seemingly ignored this stuff?
I think different reasons in different cases. It was hard to conceive of how much dust was in the air until scientists could look down on it from above in some senses. And satellite photography has blown that picture up large. It's impossible to ignore the huge quantities of dust that are in the air. And once you realize that's the case, then you have to ask, how is that affecting the climate? How does it affect the weather? Those are enormously important questions in science right now.
My guest is Hannah Holmes. Her book is The Secret Life of Dust. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Now more with Hannah Holmes, author of The Secret Life of Dust, a book which covers everything from blowing sand to the carcinogenic mutagens we cook up in our kitchens.
More recently, human life has gotten very complicated from a chemical standpoint, and we add all sorts of things to our house dust, including all the stuff that we cook. That stuff flies up into the air in enormous quantities. Before you can see smoke from what you're cooking, you're already breathing a huge amount of whatever it is.
There was one example you gave of, I think it was women in China, who apparently suffer, I think, lung cancer at the same rate as American women, but women in China don't typically smoke.
Yeah, they seem to typically, well, the high-risk population seems to typically fry their food, and they fry in a particularly dangerous kind of oil that we don't use here. And that burning oil enters their lungs and gives them lung cancer. That's how it appears.
In our Western houses, part of the problem, your scientists say, is that our houses are also too tight.
Yes, we're really stewing ourselves in our dust these days. I think when we lived in caves, we had a lot more air exchange in a given day. And we had less sophisticated dusts. Now we have all manner of dusts. Everything that we introduce to our lives and our houses ends up in our house dust. And then we keep it locked in there for hours and hours.
And as we walk around our houses, you describe that each of us carries with us a personal cloud of dust.
That's sweet, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's your own personal cloud. And anyone who gets near you breathes your personal cloud. It's got a lot of skin flakes in it, because we shed millions of those. A lot of skin flakes that one scientist described to me as floating around you in a chimney effect, going off the top of your head in a little fountain. Lots of skin flakes. Lots of bits of your clothing. Every time you move, tiny microscopic shreds of your clothing are rubbed off your clothes, and those hang around you. But a lot of the personal cloud is still a bit of a mystery to scientists who do actually study this. It seems to be that everything you do in your day collects on your clothing, or it collects on your clothing when it's hanging in the closet. And then as you walk around, there's sort of a pig pen effect where you're just followed by the dusts of your entire life.
The skin that erupts off our heads in these fountains falls to our carpets, where it is devoured by some of the most truly frightening creatures on the planet, the dust mites.
Oh, what could be frightening about a creature that doesn't even have a head? What could be less threatening than an animal with no head? This is like a little deflated balloon with little pointy legs, and it exists just to clean up after us.
I have to say that I'm terrified of dust mites, particularly the idea that they're on the bed with me.
But you can't see them. I've actually looked, since I know they're there. I thought maybe I could see them, but they're a little too small. If you had super shiny black sheets, then there's a possibility you could see the tiny cream-colored things moving around. But the other problem here with this sort of wildlife viewing is that they're shy, and they tend to hide on the other side of the sheet from the one that you are on.
Good.
They're still there.
They are hunted, however, by predators, including the rather nasty-sounding pseudoscorpion.
Yeah, there's a wild Serengeti in your house dust. No kidding. The dust mites eat the skin, and they are in turn stalked and killed by the predatory mites that leap out from the carpet and kill them and suck them dry.
This unseen battle that goes on in our carpets, what's the effect of it?
One of the effects is that they do an awful lot of pooping, and an awful lot of people are terribly allergic to that particular protein that's found in the dust mite manure. This tends to get very concentrated in houses, especially if they're not vacuumed regularly. It tends to be concentrated in the sofa cushions, actually, most of all, and beside the bed. So that's one result of having this little zoo in our houses. But another result is just that nature comes in with us. There's no shutting nature out, and we live in an ecosystem and we produce an ecosystem. These animals are just an extension of the outdoor world.
Now that we know of all of these creatures, whether they're lovable or terrifying depends on your point of view, I guess, but now that we know about them, what can you do about them? Is there a way to get your house clean?
Well, the experts would say three things. Number one, take your shoes off when you come indoors. That brings in a huge amount of dirt and all sorts of other unpleasant things, too, like pesticides and lead. As much as half the lead dust in your house is not from your windowsills, it's from your feet, from walking around outside. Another thing that's incredibly important is to use a good doormat. One of those vinyl-backed numbers like they have in department stores are really effective. But vacuuming is also extremely important, and many vacuum cleaners don't do the greatest job. The experts recommend a model that has a little light that goes on when it has sucked up as much dust as it can. Then, if you're talking about dust mites, the most effective thing is probably just to wrap up your pillows and your mattresses in those anti-allergy container things.
And that's about all you can do.
Well, vacuum, vacuum, vacuum. And the lower you can keep the humidity in your house, the less happy your dust mites are going to be. That's difficult to do unless you live in a desert, but it can be done. You can buy a humidifier that keeps the humidity low.
And I guess the reference that most of us know about dust is, well, first the ashes to ashes part, and then dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt return.
And there will be no exceptions to that one, I'm happy to report. It gives me a bit of pleasure to think that we all are going to end up being blown out into space as little black bits of smoke. I don't know why I find that so pleasing, but perhaps it's because our solar system was built from space dust, and in the end, our human bodies are only going to enrich the dust of the cosmos. As things wind down in the solar system, our planet is most likely going to spiral in toward the sun. It's going to be engulfed in the hot outer regions of the sun and burned to a crisp. And a little bit of smoke that was us is going to waft out into the cosmos.
And I guess be recycled.
Absolutely. Over and over for the foreseeable future, which is very long, space dust will continue to come together in clumps and form solar systems. And then when those solar systems burn out, they'll produce more dust. The universe will continue to get more and more dusty with every generation of stars.
You could almost describe the story of humanity as the effort to prevent our bodies turning into dust. We all, of course, are familiar with the Egyptian mummification, and a lot of modern-day twists on that are happening right now, most of them, it seems, in California.
Yeah. Well, there are also people who really do desperately want to be dust, and they want their dust to blow around. There's some wonderful ways to get your ashes scattered these days, including being packed into firecrackers and blasted off over the ocean. But there are also folks who really resist that concept, and mummification is one of the best ways. There is a company that does it. They will mummify you and even encapsulate you in a big metal egg, and presumably that should postpone your dustification significantly.
You say the Earth is going to end up as nothing more than dust, but wasn't it at least a possibility that the Earth would end up as a burned-out cinder floating through space?
Yes, there are some chances that we'll escape that dusty fate. One is that our planet will actually be adopted by another star system, and we could be sort of kidnapped and taken away by a different star system and live a much longer life with much cooler, slower-burning stars as our new parents. And there's yet another possible outcome whereby we simply fly off into the into the cosmos by ourselves and die a very cold and lonesome death.
Hannah Holmes, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Hannah Holmes' book is The Secret Life of Dust, From the Cosmos to the Kitchen Counter, The Big Consequences of Little Things. I'm Neil Conan. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at saabusa.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It took the nerve of a con man to bring anesthetics to the operating room. Coming up, we talk with Julie Fenster about Ether Day and the introduction of painless surgery. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reflects on the work of Dutch abstract painter Piet Mondrian. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Neil Conan. The surgeon who examined the body of William Morton recognized the face of the man who lay dead. "Young gentlemen," he said, turning to his students, "you see lying before you a man who has done more for humanity and for the relief of suffering than any man who has ever lived." That's some eulogy. Author Julie Fenster has some other words to describe the man who introduced anesthetics to surgery. Cheat, embezzler, con man, swindler, sneak, check kiter, mail fraud, scoundrel, imposter, fortune hunter, and mountebank. Julie Fenster's new book about William Morton and his colleagues is titled Ether Day, The Strange Tale of America's Greatest Medical Discovery and the Haunted Men Who Made It. She joins us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you, Neil.
Describe for us, if you will, just the idea is chilling enough, but surgery before anesthetic.
Well, I think you can kind of imagine not only did the patients have to feel every stroke of the surgeon's scalpel or knife or saw, but they also had to see and they also had to hear. And these memories were so haunting that quite a few patients would actually go insane or have mental problems. Those, on the other hand, were the survivors. Quite a few people opted not to have surgery and just died of the disease or committed suicide even.
Ether Day is October 16th, 1846. The scene is an operating theater at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. A man named Gilbert Abbott is sitting in a chair in anticipation of the agony that will ensue when a tumor on his neck is removed. William Morton comes up with a glass contraption containing ether, and you say he doesn't have a clue as to what he's doing.
And apparently he doesn't need to, because he strides into the room half hour late, addresses some of the greatest surgeons in America at the time, addresses also his patient to whom he administers his ether concoction, and a few minutes later the world observes the first operation ever conducted without any pain, without any screaming, without any agony, and the room erupted into cheering. It was such a fantastic achievement for one with so little preparation for it.
Ether and nitrous oxide were known 50 years before Ether Day. What took so long for this application of them to be made?
Well, I think that's a pretty profound question, because humanity had given up hope. And whenever that happens, it's quite a tragedy. And in this case, it was an especial tragedy, because what were those two substances being used for? Entertainment. They were in the hands mostly of teenagers or who had ether frolics for their friends, you know, sniffing and cavorting.
The recreational drugs of their day.
Yeah, and relatively harmless. Adults condone the use of ether, and I don't think there was ever too much harm done. And also what the equivalent of vaudeville entertainment. There were nitrous oxide or laughing gas lectures where people would come through, people would arrive just to watch other members of the audience go up on stage and sniff laughing gas and sometimes bump and bruise themselves, which made the audience laugh, but without feeling it.
And your story really begins when a man named Horace Wells attends one of these entertainments in New York City.
Yeah, well, in Hartford, Connecticut, actually. He was a dentist there, and while on stage, he noticed one of his friends got all bruised and bleeding from bumping into some furniture. He said to his friend, "Sam, you know, look at your legs. Did that hurt?" And Sam said, What's wrong with my legs? I didn't feel anything." And that bong, that's when Horace Wells said, "Maybe this would be good in my dental practice and maybe even in surgery, too."
So anyway, Horace Wells takes this lesson from the theater.
Yeah.
And he uses nitrous oxide to become the world's first painless dentist. Yeah. He then proposes that it would work in surgery as well, and somehow gets hooted out of the operating theater.
I think that he had a very retiring personality, and the operation was mostly a success. He pulled a tooth out of a volunteer at Massachusetts General Hospital, but the patient made a little groan afterward, and the audience was so ready for this to be called humbug that at the sound of the groan, they hooted him right off the dais and then right out of the city. He ended up becoming very sick. He was so depressed.
his former partner then, William Morton, ends up talking to a scientist by the name of Charles Jackson. One of them, and there's more about that later, comes up with the idea of trying ether instead. Morton is the guy who plunges ahead, and he plunges ahead just incredibly quickly. What, this all happens in the space of a couple of weeks?
Yeah, I think, I toted up. I really think that all three of them together devoted about 5 or 6 hours to the research for this. So when we say they weren't prepared for what came next, I think there's no question. But Jackson was a brilliant, brilliant chemist, and he was so well trained in Paris and at Harvard. I think he thought that Morton was just a tool, was just a puppet. But Morton didn't think he was a puppet. He thought he was in command of this discovery, and he plunged ahead and gained permission to demonstrate ether at Mass General, which was Ether Day.
Now, Morton, you describe as a young man with an eye for the main chance.
Yeah, there's no doubt. He was a con man, an official. I think it was on his income tax return, occupation con man, but he really was. He also was very opportunist where women were concerned. He had an eye not for ladies, but for wealthy ladies, and that was the direction of his life. He'd grown up very poor. A lot of people do without becoming con men, but he really needed money for his own, somehow his own personality, his gratification. So he did a terrible thing, though, I have to tell you, Neil. Maybe not a terrible thing, but an abrupt thing. He patented ether just before he demonstrated it. He tried to gain a U.S. patent and was eventually issued one.
And that is something that no other physician before him ever had, was a patent attorney.
Exactly. It was really shocking to a profession that had prided itself on the fact that any discovery was open to all, that, you know, humanitarian considerations were far more important than monetary ones. All of that kind of idealistic talk went out the window when William Morton came on the scene, because he made it clear that there was money to be made in alleviating suffering. And he was right. I'm sorry to say he was right.
You were talking about William Morton as being late to that first operation on Ether Day, and he was late not because he was worried about the ether, but he was worried about his contraption. He was worried about an invention.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to patent something that's as basic as the substance sulfuric ether, then you want to add as many elements to it, you know, so that it makes it individual, you know, proprietary. So one of the things he came up with was his apparatus that looked kind of like an old-fashioned coffee pot with some hoses attached, I think. And you didn't really need it. I think it was just as effective to put ether on a handkerchief, but he couldn't patent a handkerchief, so he came up with this apparatus. But he was such a over-energetic, kind of a goofy guy, that he decided at the last possible minute to change the apparatus all around. And that's why he was at the instrument makers when he was still due at the hospital. He's sitting with an instrument maker trying to figure out how to make the apparatus work. But he eventually got to the operation and with as much secrecy as he could, he administered the ether.
And though he is administering ether for the first time to a surgical patient with a device he has never seen before.
Yeah, never used. but with all the confidence, see, now this is why I think, you know, we asked before, why did it take the world 50 years or so, you know, to promote this great discovery? Well, I think it's because it took a con man. I think sometimes you need a man who seems to have nothing to lose and just goes ahead. And that's the kind of guy, I think Jackson would have been testing the idea for the next, you know, 36 years, because he was a scientist and very careful, and that's obviously admirable, but the world needed Morton for all of his foibles.
My guest is Julie Fenster. Her book is called Ether Day. Be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Julie Fenster's new book is Ether Day, The Strange Tale of America's Greatest Medical Discovery and the Haunted Men Who Made It. Well, the patent, as it turns out, is worthless. There is no fortune to be made for any of these men. Yet the battle for the credit for this discovery continues for decades afterwards. Jackson, it seems, is motivated in part by his unwillingness to accept the idea that Morton, this con man, could possibly have been involved in anything as grand as this.
Yeah, he didn't want his name ever uttered in the same book. I mean, it couldn't be mentioned in the same paragraph with Morton because Jackson was, you know, on a different level. But they fought over the credit, and a lot of inventors fight over credit for obvious reasons, you know, immortality being one of them. But that patent entered into a lot of the bitterness. I think that both Wells and Jackson felt resentful that a discovery that should have been more humanitarian had been sullied by this money-making scheme of Morton's. So it's part of the reason they refused to say, oh, all three of us contributed, you know, in a nice way, was because they partially wanted to squelch Morton's kind of attitude. They wanted to distance themselves from his commercialism.
And we look at Morton, and to some degree you almost have to, as a caricature, as, you know, snidely whiplash character trying to make money out of this thing.
Except he was charming. That was the thing. Snidely but charming.
And in a way, you say he was right. This was the future.
Yeah. I think that he was the first modern man. I think the 1840s, in a lot of ways, are more similar, much more similar to our current day than the 1830s. You know, I think there was a sea change in the pace of American life and the attitude toward commercialism, and Morton was swept in with that. I think he would be perfectly comfortable if he were alive today. Jackson would be lost, you know, waiting for somebody to pay him respect.
I'm fascinated by some of the reaction then in the mid-19th century as this great boon to mankind is introduced. There are some who oppose it, partly because of this patent controversy.
That's right. Yeah.
But others oppose it as the work of Satan.
Yeah. Part of the reason why the world had given up hope for remedy for pain was that pain was part of God's will, you see. And you could accept pain because of that, because part of being human was admitting that you weren't always in control of your own body, you know, God or nature or something like that was. So this was kind of a philosophical change, too. Not that there hadn't been other more or less painkillers of different kinds, but this was so complete and gave so much more power to physicians than they'd ever had before.
In your subtitle, these men who made this discovery are described as haunted, and it seems to me that the third character, Horace Wells, is in many ways the saddest.
Yeah, and he, I think he is, in for two reasons, I guess. One is that he was a very sweet man, and he only wanted, you know, he once wrote to his parents, "It is my sincere desire to do as much good as possible, and I hope and pray that no selfish motive may ever influence me to go contrary to this principle." But he lived it. He didn't just write it to his parents. That's the way he was, to a great extent. And so it's rather sad that he was overwhelmed by William Morton. And because of that, because he was crushed, he ended up committing suicide only 2 years after Ether Day.
He was also had his head turned, it seemed, when he was in Paris and was among those claimants or put forward as among the claimants to the title of the discoverer of ether.
Yeah, he had his one moment. I guess my heart goes out to him, so almost everything is rather sad. And he had one moment in Paris when he was hailed as the true discoverer and taken through the streets and paraded around. And then he came back to America and things were so different here and he was so powerless, really, that he became very quickly a chloroform addict and took his own life.
The peripheral characters in the story are almost as riveting as the main ones. Along the way, We meet Charles Jackson's brother-in-law, Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Henry
David Thoreau and Louisa May Alcott make cameo appearances.
Yes.
Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., the father of the great Supreme Court Justice, who gave anesthetic its name. We meet Charles Dana, who wrote 2 Years Before the Mast. He weighs in on this controversy and this battle over who gets the credit. It was like the O.J. case of its day.
Oh, what a good analogy. It's true, because everybody, they called it the dreaded controversy. And everybody had to back one of these three men. It was just somehow you could almost go up to people and say, are you a Democrat or Republican, Morton or Jackson? You know, And Morton had Massachusetts General Hospital on his side, and that's not inconsequential. And Jackson had Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was, I'm sure you know, much more than just a writer than he was a popular idol. And those were the kind of factions that lined up, because what Morton was really trying to do after the patent fell apart was convince the U.S. government to give him $100,000 or $200,000 in, you know, consideration for the fallen patent. So that's what kept the controversy alive.
Eventually, he takes the case to court, and it's thrown out. The judge said, you can't possibly patent this.
Yeah, they say that ether, being, as you know, just a substance, that court case probably should have happened. That court case was, I think, on to about 1860. If only they had had it around Ether Day in the late 1840s, it would have saved this dreaded controversy. But Morton knew that and purposely wouldn't let it go to court until he had.
Because he was afraid of that very ruling.
Exactly. Once that ruling came through, he a lot of wind went out of his sails. So. It's a case for patent history as well as medical and social history.
Morton ends up also dying in the city of New York, not committing suicide in a cell in the Tombs the way Wells did, but in a carriage under great, obviously, mental stress.
Yeah. Well, it was a very hot day, and he was under terrible strain because a new article in a major magazine had come out backing Jackson, and he was alone in his hotel room and sort of went a little bit insane day by day until finally he took a carriage ride in Central Park and went mad and dove into a pond and was pulled out and died about an hour later. So, he died in a state of terrible agony, I would say.
At the age of what, 48?
Yeah, about 47 or 48. Still such a young man, really, but he devoted his entire career to the dreaded controversy.
Thanks very much.
Well, thank you so much.
Julie Fenster's book is Ether Day, The Strange Tale of America's Greatest Medical Discovery and the Haunted Men Who Made It. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz considers the work of abstract painter Piet Mondrian. This is Fresh Air. An exhibit at Harvard of Piet Mondrian's transatlantic paintings got our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz thinking about the relationship between abstraction and emotion. Lloyd's been wondering how paintings, which seem so cool, have so much power over him.
The history of art, from the time of the cave paintings, is a history of the intersection between reality and abstraction. Any work of art, even a great photograph, is both less than a complete photograph and more. There's always some element of abstraction, design, structure, repetition. The Dutch painter Piet Mondrian began as a painter of realistic images, but his paintings of grids, simple black lines against a white background filled in with blocks of red, yellow, and blue, are the primary example of the most austere qualities of abstract painting. They have no intrinsic or explicit emotional content. Yet like a Cézanne painting of apples or a Mozart string quartet, they're not only beautiful, but extraordinarily poignant, filled with mysterious implications, unsettling tensions, and dramatic juxtapositions. Of course, I can imagine real objects, Dutch interiors, mazes of rooms and corridors, or Manhattan streets with flashing lights, as in his famous painting, Broadway Boogie Woogie. Mondrian loved boogie woogie piano and often played jazz records while he painted. And skyscrapers under construction, little elevators speckling the precarious open air girders. I've been thinking about these issues since I saw the small but thrilling show of Mondrian's transatlantic paintings at Harvard's Busch Reisinger Museum. Mondrian had been living in Paris, but before the Nazi invasion, he moved to London, then to New York, where he arrived in 1940 at the age of 70 with a bunch of paintings he regarded as finished. But for his first New York show, he decided to repaint these canvases. He changed the relationship between the black lines in his grids, moved them closer together or further apart, wiped some out, added others. Even more surprising, he placed right next to one another, as he rarely did in his earlier work, areas of different colors, especially around the edges of the canvases, without boxing them inside the black lines. Narrow red rectangles now bump up against narrow yellow rectangles. Little red, yellow, or blue squares dot the perimeters. On a ghostly, unfinished canvas, you can see lines being rubbed out, areas of color in the process of being altered. These small patches of color are like eyes winking. They add a kind of festivity and charm that's rare in Mondrian. Each of these paintings is signed with a tiny PM in red paint at the bottom of one of the black stripes. Two dates of composition, 5 or 6 years apart, also in red, appear over another black line. One part of this exhibit includes interactive computer programs that allow you, through X-rays, ultraviolet light, infrared images, and microscopic observation, to trace the various stages of these paintings. One started out as mostly the black and white framework, with four small yellow squares near the bottom right. These became four blue squares. Mondrian added more lines and moved others, some only slightly. In the final version, there's only one small blue square, the one human touch in the anonymous structure, the open eye looking out at the world, at you. It's surprising to see these Mondrians in person. In reproduction, the surfaces are slick, perfect. In real life, you can see the vivid brushstrokes. Many of the canvases are cracked and fragile, which only heightens your sense of the precariousness of these images. Far from the cool, detached artist, the artist of rational balance, Mondrian turns out really to have been the artist of exploration, of experiment, of the obsessive, maybe even desperate attempt to find balance and harmony. The pure geometry, like musical notes or form and meter in poetry, keeps the artist literally from going to pieces. And each new painting is an admission that the search for that perfect harmony isn't over, can never be over. Some of these late paintings also show a new spirit of, what is it, almost frivolity. Is it the joy of creation in the face of impending catastrophe? All things fall and are built again, Yeats wrote in 1938 in his poem Lapis Lazuli. And those that build them again are gay. This joy doesn't deny the underlying tragic nature of human life. It's a kind of heroism. Yeats died the following year. In 1939, Mondrian still believed these paintings were finished. But he escaped the war with a new life at 70, in a new country, in a city that excited him. Gaiety, Yeats says earlier in that same poem, which not only shows us what art can do in the shadow of worldwide political crisis, but the heroism each of us is capable of in the face of our own inevitable mortality. Gaiety transfiguring all that dread.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. His latest book of poems is Cairo Traffic. He reviewed an exhibit of Piet Mondrian's transatlantic paintings, which opens at the Dallas Museum of Art on Sunday. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Showrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Neil Conan.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Universal Pictures, presenting Captain Corelli's Mandolin from the director of Shakespeare in Love, starring Nicolas Cage and Penelope Cruz, opens August 17th nationwide. And from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Niagara Falls All Over Again, a novel by Elizabeth McCracken, the author of The Giant's House. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Others, we meet Spanish film director Alejandro Amenábar, whose new horror film is inspired by the work of Hitchcock and Hammer Films. Also, we talk with Alan Kurzweil about his literary thriller, The Grand Complication. I'm Neil Conan. Join us for the next Fresh Air.